months down the road, and then there's a cutoff point. If so, how do I know when the cutoff point is reached? I'm making a joke out of it, but it was terrifying to many people. Are our choices free? Could Macbeth have done other than he does? This lecture is about one speech only, the soliloquy that Macbeth utters at the beginning of Act 1, Scene 7. It would be helpful to you in following it if you had a copy of the speech in front of you. I have spoken about soliloquies before. Soliloquies in early Shakespeare tend to be direct address to the audience. When Richard III comes out and tells us his plots, he is directly sharing those plots with us, inviting us to join in as silent co-conspirators. He hides no secrets from us. He knows everything he's going to say to us the moment he opens his mouth. But as Shakespeare goes on in his career, his soliloquies become more interior. We get inside the man more. Hamlet still does some direct address, reasoning with us, but at times we're really following Hamlet's reasoning, so that we get a feeling, and then we get him standing back and looking at that feeling, surprised to say, to have heard himself say, the things he's just said, taking different tracks, not having thought it out, but thinking it out just now. With Macbeth, we reach the fullness of that process. Macbeth's soliloquy, if it were done, is musing, is the interior life of a man who is not an extrovert, who does not go around exposing himself to all and sundry. I mean, he's a villain, like Richard III. But unlike Richard III, he's not an ironist, he's not an entertainer, he doesn't joke with us. He's alone with his thoughts. He muses. He is often rapt. That's a key word for him, used several times in the play. Look how our partner's wrapped. He's seized. He's enclosed in the thoughts, the images of his own mind. And the images of his own mind are extremely powerful. He has a notable imagination. We just happen to overhear him by theatrical convention as he pursues his thoughts, not knowing what he will think next. He doesn't know either. Often he surprises himself. And he thinks associatively, not logically. He may not be fully conscious of the process by which he moves from one idea or one emotion to the next, so that he comes out with things he doesn't intend to. The most effective portrayal of Macbeth's soliloquies that I've seen on stage has been from Ian McKellen, and that performance is still available on videotape. McKellen had developed a kind of mannerism, a trick of ignoring the period, the grammatical period, the full stop in the sentence, so that he would overrun the end of a sentence and take into the same breath the first words of the next sentence. Then he would pause and realize, hey, I've gotten into a different thought. Where does that go? And then run forward, overrunning the next period. Eventually, this got to be a very annoying mannerism. It was like watching a dancer who's always on the off beat. But in this case, for Macbeth, it was very effective. The man's mind and feelings outrun his conscious intention. This soliloquy makes a decision. He decides not to commit murder. It is important to ask, for us to ask, as we listen to it, why is he deciding not to commit murder? Is this a practical decision that he can't get away with it? Or is it a moral decision that murder is a bad thing to do? Let us take it chunk by chunk. If it were done, when 'tis done, then 'twere well, it were done quickly. The opening is a generalization, a proposition, as the beginnings of Shakespeare's soliloquies often are. As Bassanio says, so may the outward shows be least themselves, a generalization about appearance and reality. Or as Hamlet says, to be or not to be, that is the question. Here, if it were done, when 'tis done, then 'twere well. It were done quickly. There's an odd pause even in this generalization. Should there be a comma at the end of the line? Is he saying, if it were done when 'tis done, then 'twere well? That is, if it is done, completed, finished, accomplished, no consequences, when 'tis done, in the sense of performed, then 'twere well, then it's okay. If I can get away with it, in other words. Or is it a matter of deciding how to do it? Is that a fresh thought? It were done quickly. Let's get it done right away. He seems to be hovering between two different thoughts. It's characteristic of Macbeth that he isn't quite sure what he's saying. It is also characteristic of Macbeth that there's something in the background, something perhaps in the unconscious, because the line is almost a quotation. "That thou doest, do quickly," was said on a very famous occasion. It was said by Jesus to Judas at the Last Supper. "One of you will betray me. Is it I? Is it I, Lord?" And he says quietly to Judas, "That thou doest, do quickly. Go, get it over with. I can't bear the waiting." And if that echo is alive in our minds, it's appropriate, for Macbeth is playing the Judas role to his king. He is about to betray his king. But the most important word in that opening, in that first line and a half, the most frequent word, is "it." It occurs four times. I think it's significant that Macbeth cannot name the thing he is talking about. He's keeping it at arm's length. He doesn't say murder, he doesn't say killing, he just says "it." Then he goes on and gets a little more specific. "If the assassination could trammel up the consequence and catch with his surcease success." Well, this is a little more specific. At least he's giving a noun to the action. It's assassination. But in fact, that's a rather exotic term, a euphemism for killing. This is the first time the word assassination occurs in the written English language, according to the Oxford English Dictionary. It's an unusual word. It comes from the Arabic. There was a tribe whose name for themselves sounded to the Crusaders like assassin. And they were supposed to be particularly ferocious in attack. So in the European languages, the languages of the Crusaders who encountered this group of Arabs, the word assassin came to mean killer. And the word assassin does begin to turn up fairly frequently in English in the 16th century. But it's only now, 1606, that is the beginning of the 17th century, that the full abstract form, assassination, gets written down. So it's like referring to sexual intercourse, not with a crude word beginning with F, but something like coitus or sexual congress, a euphemism. Not touching it directly, handling it with tongs. And likewise, catch with his surcease success. To talk of somebody's being murdered as his surcease is, again, indirect, handling it with gloves. And notice, he doesn't name Duncan either. It's just his. He's scared of this subject. "That but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all." Now, finally, with the word "blow," we get a concrete noun. This is going to involve a stroke with a knife, a blow. And he wants that to be the be-all and the end-all. He wants no bad consequences, no incriminating evidence, nothing. "Here, but here, upon this bank and shoal of time, we jump the life to come." Now, to complete the sense of that first sentence, what he's saying is, if we can get away with it, here on this bank of time, here in the world, here on earth, then I'll forget about the life to come. I will not think about it in religious, judgmental terms. I will not worry about what God thinks about it, as long as I can get away with it amongst men. That's the sense of the opening six lines of the speech. But it is, there's an extraordinary emphasis here, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all here, but here upon this bank and shoal of time. You'll notice there's a pause just before the end of the line. Might be the be-all and the end-all here. It is very difficult for an actor to pause just before the last word of an iambic pentameter line. All the energy of the line rushes through to the end. Yet we've got a full stop there. And thus, tremendous emphasis coming down on the word here, which is doubled because the word here opens the next line. Be all and the end all here, but here, upon this bank and shoal of time. Okay, I'm going to think entirely in practical terms, Macbeth is saying. Think about the worldly consequences of the crime, and only that. The consequences in time, which is described as a bank and a shoal. That is, time is some kind of sea or lake or river, and it has a bank beside it. And we're going to stay on the bank and stay clear of the water. But that's a kind of difficult image. It's difficult to think of. The moment you begin defining time, you have to define it in relation to something else. What do you define it in relation to? Well, obviously, eternity. Is the bank time? And if you jump there, if you jump the life to come, aren't you likely to get a bit wet if you go around jumping on the edge of a body of water? There may be some sense that Macbeth cannot do what he wants to do, that is, think of it only in earthly terms. But that word shoal is also ambiguous. In the text, in the first folio, which is the only early text of Macbeth that we have, it is spelled S-C-H-O-O-L-E. That is, it looks like school. And in fact, it is ambiguous. The Elizabethans spelt the word shoal and the word school the same way. They pronounced it differently. Burbage, in uttering this line, had to say either shoal or school. But we don't know which he said. We don't know which Shakespeare meant. It could be this bank and school of time. In which case, time is a school, and the bank part is the lecture hall. I mean, those raised tiers that the students in a big lecture hall sit in. Time is a place where we learn lessons. Why? Because eventually we have to go out of the school and apply them in the world. As with the river image, time implies an opposite, eternity. Do you learn your lessons well? They will determine your fate elsewhere. And there's one possible other meaning for the bank here, and that is bank can also be a judge's bench. It is the English word for a court, the court of the king's bench. Time may be a courtroom where we receive trial and sentence, which, of course, will govern where we spend eternity. I know you think I'm making all of this up. Now, I've got three meanings going for this bank and school or shoal of time. But I think all three are evident in Macbeth's mind as he proceeds, although not at the moment he says that phrase, they come out. In these cases, we still have judgment here, he says. Well, that certainly is the courtroom sense of the word bank. In these cases, legal cases, we still have judgment here. We can get judged here. We don't need to worry about eternity. We may get judged here on earth for committing murder. That we but teach bloody instructions. There's the schoolroom image surfacing. If we commit murder, we're people teaching other people how to commit murder. Macbeth is facing the problem that Bolingbroke faced. If you depose a king, you prove that kings are deposable and implicitly invite others to depose you. We but teach bloody instructions, which being taught return to plague the inventor. This even-handed justice commends the ingredients of our poisoned chalice to our own lips. Justice is even-handed. Now that image we still know, we are still familiar with. It is on the front of half the courthouses in America, justice with her scales, weighing things. But Macbeth has slightly altered it. It isn't scales. Justice is a person who hands a chalice, a cup of wine, to somebody else, poisoned, and then receives it back. Or if you hand poisoned wine to somebody, they may pass it back to you. What goes around comes around. That is, he's afraid of the consequences of crime If he commits murder, he himself will be judged, or he himself will be murdered. Even in a practical sense, even here on Earth, you start using poison, other people will start using poison too. Now, I've referred to this vessel of wine as a cup or a goblet, but that's not the word that Macbeth uses for it. He refers to it as a chalice, which is, of course, a kind of goblet, a very fancy kind of goblet. But for 2,000 years of Western history, well, in Shakespeare's time, only 1,600 years of Western history, it has been a very special kind of cup indeed. It's the cup used in the communion service, in the Eucharist. So apparently, in Macbeth's mind, he isn't entirely divorcing himself from religious sanctions about murder, from Christian considerations. It isn't wholly practical. But he tries to wrench himself back to the practical, to the earthly, to the worldly. He's here in double trust. First, as I am his kinsman and his subject, strong both against the deed. Then, and his as his host, who should against his murderer shut the door, not bear the knife myself. Now, about those lines, I have several things to say. First, it's the clearest example of how Macbeth's associations run away with him. He's saying he's here in double trust. And then he names three things. Kinsman, subject, host. It's like the Monty Python joke about the Spanish Inquisition. Fear is the great weapon of the Spanish Inquisition. Fear and terrible accuracy. But fear and accuracy are the two great weapons of the Spanish Inquisition. And so on and so on, and they multiply. Double trust turns out to be three things. His tongue runs away with him. His associations run away with him. But they do manage to remain fairly worldly. The kin connection is an earthly connection. We are supposed to be loyal to our kin. The subject connection, he's sworn obedience to Duncan. He owes him protection. He would be violating that bond of trust as well. And finally, as host, the relationship between host and guest is protected, is special, particularly in a primitive society like the Scotland of this play. Hospitality has a very high value because, of course, a host and a guest are enormously at each other's mercy. And therefore, in all primitive societies, it's in all over Homer as well, the guest-host relationship is particularly sacred. These are strong against the deed. He should against the murderer shut the door, not bear the knife myself. These are worldly arguments. But they are also ultimately religious arguments. The sanction for the kin tie, for the vow of the subject, and for the hospitality relationship is ultimately divine. And for Macbeth to mention a host three lines after mentioning a chalice suggests very much that somewhere underneath his mind is the ceremony of the Eucharist. It's reasonable enough for him to think of it. And the thing is open, the scene is opened with a procession of servants going by with material for Duncan's supper. Enter a sewer and divers servants with dishes and service over the stage. That is, the plates, the crockery, the silverware, and presumably the goblets also. It may be just because he's seen some cups being passing by, that Macbeth comes up with this chalice image. But then he has his own association for it, chalice, host. This supper won't stay in its place just as a supper in Inverness. And well, it shouldn't. After all, what supper is Duncan eating out there? Which of the many suppers in Duncan's life is he consuming just at the moment? His last one, of course. His last. And Duncan, as an anointed king, is the representative of Christ in this society. Well, I think this web of subconscious associations just gets too strong for Macbeth to keep down, to keep in his subconscious. It breaks out. Besides, this Duncan, well, he's finally named the man. You have the feeling that the underthoughts are indeed breaking through. This Duncan hath borne his faculties so meek, hath been so clear in his great office, that his virtues will plead like angels trumpet-tongued against the deep damnation of his taking off. Now that really is a rush of words. A gorgeous rush of words and a very powerful rush of words. He's finally named the thing that he is afraid of. Damnation. And there is a biblical association for what he is doing. St. Paul had written in his letter to the Corinthians, in writing about the Eucharist, "Wherefore, whosoever shall eat this bread and drink this cup of the Lord unworthily shall be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. For he that eateth and drinketh unworthily eateth and drinketh damnation." That's the link in Macbeth's Christian culture, between the eating and the drinking and the idea of damnation. That killing Duncan will be a damnable deed as well as a deed that's dangerous on earth. In fact, he's got even a larger context for it. At line 18, Duncan's virtues will plead like angels trumpet-tongued against this deep damnation. He's thinking of particular virtues. There is a medieval allegory invented by St. Bernard of Clairvaux that in the beginning, when Adam and Eve fell in the garden, there was a debate took place in heaven before the throne of God. And the four daughters of God appeared before the throne and pleaded, that in the legal sense, made cases to God. The four daughters of God are justice, truth, mercy, and peace. And justice said man must be punished. He has sinned. And you said that if he ate the apple, he would die. And truth supports justice. And she adds, it is indeed true that you said those things. It is indeed true that Adam and Eve have sinned. Therefore, they must die. Mercy tries to intervene and say, God, you are merciful. I am as much a daughter of God, that is an attribute of God, as justice and peace, justice and truth are. You must extend mercy or you will no longer be God. And peace joins mercy, saying, this is deplorable that there should be this argument in heaven at all. And besides, if you don't grant mercy to man, there will be no peace between heaven and earth. How is God to decide? Justice and mercy, justice and truth on the one hand, mercy and peace on the other. God must have all of them if he is to be God. Well, the answer, of course, was the birth of Christ. Christ, by living and dying on the cross, takes the just penalty, fulfills the truth, and makes mercy and peace available to mankind. And this is a very familiar allegory for Shakespeare's time. It was the way the Middle Ages and the Renaissance dramatized a great problem. How could God be simultaneously just and merciful? The fact that God was both these things could be very nicely pictured on the wall of a church by drawing God as an old man on a throne with the four daughters arguing before him, or dramatizing it in a play, which was done quite a number of times in the Middle Ages and early Renaissance. Here, the virtues will plead like angels, but suddenly the time event, the time frame of that pleading is accelerated. It becomes trumpet-tongued. It's moved from the beginning of things to the end of things, to the great trump at the end, to the last judgment against the deep damnation of his taking off. And pity, like a naked newborn babe. Remember, the result of the debate of the four daughters was the birth of pity, mercy, as a naked newborn babe in the manger in Bethlehem. Pity, like a naked newborn babe striding the blast, or heaven's cherubim horsed upon the sightless couriers of the air. Again, there's been a tremendous acceleration of the religious imagery. The Christ child goes from being the baby to delivering the last judgment, coming down on the blast, becoming Michelangelo's terrible Christ, the Christ of the last judgment in the Sistine Chapel, hurling the sinners down to hell in such a terrible way that even the Virgin turns aside from him. Cannot bear the sight of all this damnation. heaven's cherubim horsed upon the sightless couriers of the air shall blow the horrid deed in every eye that tears may drown the wind. Those trumpets are still going. The trumpet tongues of the virtues who are pleading like angels, come with the cherubim, come with the cherubim's horses, the sightless couriers of the air, and they are blowing the horrid deed all over the world, creating tremendous storms and bringing the rain, the universal rain of all mankind's tears at the horrible deed of murdering Duncan. Macbeth is surrounded by universal tempest, and it's all in condemnation of him. This is tremendous Baroque imagery. It is like the painting on of the ceiling of a Baroque church, where you do have angels blowing trumpets in the corners and figures streaming across, and souls ascending and descending. Macbeth has an extraordinary imagination. He does not seem to be able to argue out in sober reason the morality of a case. What he has is a vision of the morality of the case. He sees the wickedness of murdering Duncan as embodied in this vision of virtues and angels and the last trump and the sightless couriers of the air and this universal storm. He will be isolated. Storm, tears, wind, everyone consumed with horror at this deed. And he himself is left alone. I have no spur, in the final lines of the soliloquy, I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent, but only vaulting ambition, which o'erleaps itself and falls on the other. In comparison to that vast supernatural drama, with angels and angelic horses flying through the air, he is a mere mortal, and he has no spur to prick the sides of his intent except vaulting ambition. He's only got an ordinary earthly horse of normal flesh and blood. In fact, it's not even that. It's vaulting ambition, and he leaps on it only to fall on the other side. It isn't even a living horse. It's that wooden thing down in the gymnasium, a vaulting horse. And if you don't know how to use it, if you're not a properly trained gymnast and you try to jump on it, you'll fall off on the other side. That's the futility of Macbeth's attempt to get away with murder. In comparison to the divine and human drama that will recoil upon him, he is merely jumping over a piece of wood and not getting anywhere. The blow that started this speech, the blow that might be the be-all, turns into the blowing trumpets of damnation and condemnation. The jumping the life to come, his hope to escape thought of condemnation in the last judgment, merely becomes an overleaping that falls on the other side. The story of Macbeth is the story of a man who leapt in hope, but even as he did so, he knew he could not complete that leap successfully. In fact, he doesn't even complete the leap in this speech, because it ends without the full stop. I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent, but only vaulting ambition which o'erleaps itself and falls on the other. Some editions add the word side, supposing that it just got left out of the original text. I don't think that's what happened. What Shakespeare means is Lady Macbeth comes in and cuts him off. Here's the spur. Here's what's going to help him do this. Macbeth has decided he will not do this. He has decided it not clearly. I don't know whether he's conscious of everything I've just described as going on in these words. I am sure what is going on, I'm sure it's there. You can look up all the words in the Oxford English Dictionary and follow these trains of thought. but it is Macbeth's peculiar inner nature that he experiences it as a feeling, as a series of feelings and a set of associations. He couldn't sit down and diagram the argument. It is a wonderful, exciting piece of writing. You get inside a man's mind, and you know more about him than he consciously knows about himself. Enter two murderers. That is a frequent stage direction in Shakespeare. The hired thugs of Richard III. There are murderers also hired in Macbeth. It occurs elsewhere in other plays. The great Shakespearean scholar Alfred Harbidge, who was at Harvard in the middle of the century, once remarked that the whole play of Macbeth might be considered an expansion of the stage direction, Enter Two Murderers, taking it seriously, not just a couple of hired thugs, but the lead roles of the play. It is the unusual achievement of this play that we are brought into sympathy with two murderers. Shakespeare never allows us to forget the wickedness and horror of their crimes, but we see that wickedness as it tears apart the perpetrators, not the victims. Except for the England scene and the scenes that concentrate on Macduff and his family, we always are focusing upon the consciousness of Macbeth and his lady. This is a striking theatrical and psychological move. It is, after all, easy to make touching the suffering of decent people who suffer abuse. Television shows that practically every night. It is rarer that we are shown the pain of wicked people, of people who know their deeds are wicked even as they commit them. Moreover, this is not the sort of story that has become popular in the 20th century, where we sympathize with evildoers because we are made to understand the psychological origin of their wickedness, where we are told the sad story of some youngsters who were badly brought up, who suffered abuse, who were subject to irresistible pressures, and therefore their crimes are not only understandable but forgivable. That kind of explanation, that kind of easy sympathy, we are not given. We are not given that kind of background, that sort of early biography for Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. They are tempted and they fall. That is it. And their crime, in fact, is not the result of irresistible pressures insofar as we can humanly tell. Their crime is, in fact, unnecessary. The prophecy that Macbeth has received from the witches is unconditional. You will be king. Or at least Macbeth at one point recognizes it as unconditional. At one point he dismisses the whole plan from his mind by saying, if chance will have me king, then chance may crown me without my stir. I don't have to murder Duncan in order to get a crown for myself. After all, in this violent Scotland in which they live, Duncan could be killed in the next war. Malcolm could be killed. Duncan is old anyway. The crown seems to be elective amongst the royal family, and obviously Macbeth would be a leading contender whenever there was a vacancy of the crown. It could happen that Macbeth would become king without committing any crimes to get there. Further, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth do not seem to be extremely able murderers. This is not their natural given thing. That may seem to be an odd sort of judgment. We don't normally evaluate people on whether they're able to commit murder or not. And indeed, the notion of Lady Macbeth doing the killing is considered rather shocking in the play. It is startling when she says, of Duncan, had he not resembled my father as he slept, I'd have done it. I think we're meant to think, my God, I didn't even think that she might be up to sticking knives into people. That's not normally how women in this society behave. But Macbeth himself is not particularly able. He can kill in battle, He's very good at killing in battle, unseeming men from the nave to the chops. But he has to gear himself up extraordinarily to kill in a castle, to kill a king in peacetime. And he takes no pleasure from it. He is haunted by guilt the moment he has done it. It is interesting how the murder is dramatized. We don't see the killing of Duncan. That takes place off stage. What we see is hundreds of lines whereby Macbeth prepares himself to do it and then comes back on stage with the bloody daggers for more lines about his agonies having done it. The concentration is altogether on the psychology of the murderer and not on the suffering of the victim. And he doesn't ever kill again. His subsequent murders, he does it secondhand. He hires thugs to kill Banquo and Fleance, to kill the Macduff family. It is only by a strange cooperation between the two Macbeths that the murder of Duncan gets accomplished. A cooperation that is in large part sexual. Now, the degree to which it strikes us as sexual in any given performance of Macbeth will depend, of course, on the casting of the leading characters, how much their sexuality reads, how much it is a sexual relation between them. But it's there in the language throughout. Lady Macbeth imagines power. She imagines the golden round that fate in metaphysical aid doth seem to have thee crowned withal. But she feels herself obliged to suppress her womanly faculties, her specifically sexual faculties, in order to assist Macbeth to that end. I read in an earlier lecture the lines about unsex me here, come to my women's breasts and take my milk for gall. Unsex me so that I can be an adequate accessory to murder. Macbeth is driven to the crime by his imagination. And this is worked out in great detail. I want to pick up the play from the third scene of Act One, when Macbeth is given the prophecies. His response, Macbeth that art Thane of Glamis, Macbeth Thane of Cawdor, Macbeth that will be king hereafter, his immediate response is a surprising one. He is silent. He is silent for a number of lines. And Shakespeare points the fact of his silence by having Banquo say, why do you start and seem to fear? What's on your mind? It isn't for about 50 lines that Macbeth tells us what is actually on his mind. He has a long aside while Banquo talks to Ross and Angus. Two truths are told as happy prologues to the swelling act of the imperial theme. This supernatural soliciting cannot be ill, cannot be good. If ill, why hath it given me earnest of success commencing in a truth? I am Thane of Cawdor. If good, why do I yield to that suggestion whose horrid image doth unfix my hair and make my seated heart knock at my ribs against the use of nature? Present fears are less than horrible imaginings. My thought, whose murder yet is but fantastical, shakes so my single state of mind that function is smothered in surmise, and nothing is but what is not. Now that, I suggest, is an extraordinary response to a prophecy that you will be king. He thinks not of a crown, purple robes, sitting on a throne, power, sleeping with anybody you like and having ice cream every night. He thinks of murder. He's so intent on the idea of murder that it is more real to him than the thaneship of Cawdor, which he's just been told has been given to him. It is so real to him that his hair stands on end and that his heart pounds. He is wrapped in that thought. This is our introduction to Macbeth's imagination, to the extraordinary degree of its power over him, how he is wrapped in the images it produces. The fullest expression of this imaginative vision comes as he gears himself up for the murder itself, comes in the dagger soliloquy in the first scene of the second act. Is this a dagger that I see before me, the handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch thee. I have thee not, and yet I see thee still. Art thou not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? And then I'll skip a few lines and go on. Now, o'er the one-half world, nature seems dead. And wicked dreams abuse the curtained sleep. Witchcraft celebrates pale Hecate's offerings. And withered murder, alarmed by his sentinel, the wolf, whose howls his watch, thus with his stealthy pace, with Tarquin's ravishing strides, towards his design moves like a ghost. Thou sure and firm set earth, hear not my steps which way they walk. For fear thy very stones pray to my whereabouts, and take the present horror from the time which now suits with it. A very powerful speech indeed. Macbeth is imagining himself, visualizing himself, romanticizing himself. He is seeing himself as a figure in a dramatic scene. He is the murderer. This is how it should be. I am withered murder, murder with a capital M, a personification. I am like Tarquin, the great Roman villain. And all the dramatic details have got to be right. The stones must not prate of my whereabouts. Not because that would be a noise alarming the guests, waking the sleepers and preventing the murder from taking place, but because they're the wrong sound effect for murder. It would take the present horror from the time. The act of murder to him is in some way terrifically attractive. I don't mean he's a sadist. As I said earlier, he doesn't enjoy it. But somehow he's pulled to it. Somehow he finds the commission of evil in itself attractive. He finds an emotional excitement, an exaltation in the power a man has to murder. I can play this gigantic, spectacular role. I can be capital M murder, causing a breach in nature, creating that vision of Duncan with his silver skin laced with his golden blood. That imaginative desire, as much as any ambition, is part of Macbeth's motive. But his imagination is, of course, also strong against the deed. As in the soliloquy that I analyzed in the last lecture, it is his imagination that produces visions of angels trumpet-tongued against the deep damnation of killing Duncan. His imagination, in other words, needs reinforcement, needs a spur. And his wife provides that, by attacking him at his most vulnerable point, by attacking his manliness. The first characteristic of Macbeth that had been impressed upon us in this play was his courage. He is an extraordinarily brave general, fighting against both a rebel and an invader, unseeming people from the nave to the chops, Bellona's bridegroom, brave Macbeth, who doubly redoubles strokes upon the foe. It's a very bloody image, but because it's in the service of a king against invasion and rebellion, it's good. Macbeth is put in a position where this virtue of manly courage can exert a false appeal to him. He decides, in the soliloquy I last analyzed, not to murder Duncan, And then his wife comes in and tries to reverse his mind. He says, we will proceed no further in this business. And she immediately counterattacks. Was the hope drunk wherein you dressed yourself? Is this merely a weakness, something you'd say merely when you were drinking? Hath it slept since, and wakes it now to look so green and pale at what it did so freely? From this time forth, such I account thy love. Now that's even nastier than saying, were you drunk when you said you'd do this? Such I account thy love. This is, you can't even command the respect of your wife any longer. Art thou afeard to be the same in thine own act and valor as thou art in desire? Wouldst thou have that which thou esteem'st the ornament of life, and live a coward in thine own esteem, letting I dare not wait upon I would, like the poor cat in the adage? There she has said the terrible word, coward. Live a coward in your own esteem. You're going to have to think of yourself as a coward, never mind if I use the word. And the reduction of a brave general to a domestic pet. You're like the cat in the adage, the cat who wouldn't get the food because it would have to get its paws wet. In other words, she's not arguing in moral terms at all. She's not talking about angels and trumpet-tongued and deep damnation and all that kind of thing. She's going after him at a gut level. Are you man enough to do it? And he responds, prithee peace, I dare do all that may become a man. Who dares do more is none. Now, that's taking a moral stand on manliness. To do certain things are manly. To go beyond that, you would become a devil. But she takes it in other terms. She doesn't compare manliness to being a devil. She compares manliness to being a beast. What beast was it then that made you break this enterprise to me? When you durst do it, then you were a man. And to be more than what you were, you would be so much more the man. That is, manliness does not consist of a moral standard. It consists of aggression, of courage, of machismo. Nor time nor place did then adhere, and yet you would make both. They have made themselves, and their fitness now doth unmake you. And then the terrible passage about giving suck. I have given suck and know how tender 'tis to love the babe that milks me. I would, while it was smiling in my face, have plucked my nipple from its boneless gums and dashed the brains out had I so sworn as you have done to this. Now, I'm not going to talk about King Herod and killing babies anymore. I'm just going to go after the basic gut husband and wife relationship that's involved in saying such words. It means I'm a better man than you are. I'd stick to my word. And that knocks Macbeth for a loop. He cannot repeat the arguments that had occurred to himself in soliloquy. They don't seem to come back to his head about how immoral it is to kill Duncan, about the deep damnation of his taking off. All he can say is, if we should fail, what happens if it goes wrong? He's played into her hands at that point, because on that ground, on the ground of practicality, she can sweep everything before her. We fail, but screw your courage to the sticking place, and will not fail. An image taken, very appropriately, from an aggressive weapon, a crossbow. Screw your courage to the sticking place, and then let fly the arrow. Will not fail. And she goes forth with the plans about how they'll do it, and he responds, bring forth men children only, for thy undaunted metal should compose nothing but males. She is appropriate to bear only sons, not weak daughters. It is by persuading him that the murder of Duncan is a manly act whereby he fulfills his manly capacity that she gets him to do it. Macbeth is then motivated by two things besides ambition. There is this deep attractiveness in killing, And there is also a fear of cowardice, a fear of being unmanly, that does away with the moral objections to murder. And I think those two latter motivations are closely linked. You prove you are a man by murdering. That demonstrates your grown-up adult masculinity. That's why I think he invokes Tarquin in the Dagger soliloquy, with Tarquin's murdering stride. Tarquin was not, in fact, famous as a murderer. That wasn't important about him. What was important about Tarquin was rape. He was a rapist. He raped Lucretia. Shakespeare wrote a long poem about it called The Rape of Lucrece. Now, rape, I think, is a primal male action. It is one of the few physical deeds that a man can perform, but a woman cannot. And by invoking Tarquin in that way, he means to suggest, or he seems to think, he seems to be convinced, whether he's conscious of it or not, that murder is male. That the ability to do a murder is a characteristic of a male. And Lady Macbeth thinks so too. The one moment she calls him husband is the moment when he comes back from killing Duncan with those bloody daggers in his hand. That's the point where she says, "My husband." It's a marvelous touch. Now, all of this is, of course, extremely perverse. It is the corruption of a noble quality, courage, by a complete disregard for its object, for the circumstances in which it is exerted. It is the corruption of manhood by too narrow a definition of manhood. And it ruins Macbeth. It ruins his imagination, his most striking quality. Macbeth started with this play with an imagination so vivid that he saw daggers in the air, and the very thought of a murder would make his scalp prickle in that way that makes us feel our hair is standing on ends. At the end of the play, that imagination is dead. He is weary of everything. He has a desolating speech about his lack of response to any stimulus. He hears the cry of women, this terrible offstage shriek of the ladies-in-waiting of Lady Macbeth. And he remarks on it, "I have almost forgot the taste of fears. The time has been my senses would have cooled to hear a night shriek." Just to hear a single cry in the middle of night would have sent a chill down my spine. "And my fell of hair would at a dismal treatise rouse and stir as life rent. I have supped full with horrors. Direness familiar to my slaughterous thoughts cannot once start me." Then his servant comes back in and explains the cry of women. Lady Macbeth is dead. And all he can say about that is, "You timed it badly, dear. You should have died hereafter." Lady Macbeth goes through a parallel change, but it happens in reverse. At the beginning of the play, like her husband, she is exhilarated, rapt at the thought of the crime. Her exaltation comes about as the result of a deliberate act of will. She has asked evil spirits, the spirits that tend on mortal thoughts, to possess her. But unlike her husband, she has no ability to imagine consequences, no visions of angels trumpet-tongued. She energetically pushes Macbeth into the murder, making the practical plans by which it will be carried out. Her practicality in the murder scene itself is summed up in the line about the blood on their hands. "A little water clears us of this deed." Quite simple. The only thing that has to be done with blood is wash it off. By the end of the play, she has developed an imagination, a rich inner life, a moral sensitivity. Her will is broken, and she releases that imagination in the anguish of her sleep. "A little water clears us of this deed" becomes the line in the sleepwalking scene, "All the perfumes of Arabia cannot sweeten this little hand. A gorgeous line. What marks the break, the change for both of them, is the appearance of the ghost of Banquo. Lady Macbeth, of course, does not see it, and tells Macbeth to be a man and resist whatever it is that is on his mind. He asserts himself as a man and banishes the image of Banquo, thus, as it were, strangling his own imagination, his own capacity to see morality in a visual form. And thereafter he sees no more images, except the deceiving ones called up by the witches. She exhausts herself in the effort to make him command herself, and she is exhausted, in fact, asleep ever after. We never see her awake again. He retains his manhood, the aggressive courage that his wife has declared to be the essence of manhood, but in order to do it, he has killed almost all the rest of himself. A great deal of his emotional life. Indeed, at the end of that scene, the scene with the ghost, he sums up his life by saying, "For mine own good, all causes shall give way. I am in blood stepped in so far that should I wade no more, returning were as tedious as go o'er. I'm so far into blood, there's no point in going back. That would be as tedious as going forward and killing more people." Well, that's it's an understandable remark. What strikes me as odd is the adjective he uses, tedious. Now, if there's one thing that Macbeth's life has been up until this point, it's untedious. This is a man who unseams people from the nave to the chop, sees daggers in the air, meets witches, becomes king, kills his own king. This has been an exciting life. But now it is all dust and ashes for him. One consequence of this narrowing of Macbeth, of this violent limitation of his faculties, is that there is no scene of self-recognition for him. We expect a tragic character to grow in perception as the play goes on. As the tragic hero becomes ever more fixed in his situation, his faculties, his understanding, his perception grows. And I've laid stress on the self-recognition speeches of Lear and Hamlet and Othello. I am a very foolish, fond old man. I am Hamlet the Dane. Macbeth has no such speech of anagnorisis. He does not recognize anything new. He does not judge himself. He does not see himself. Instead, he judges the world. He describes life around him. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Life is meaningless. Time is merely one tick of the clock after another. Men are fools. The sun is but a candle showing us the way to the grave. In particular, we are actor fools, and bad actors at that. We strut and fret in meaningless emotion. Moreover, an actor, remember, has no choice about what he will say or do. A pre-existing script determines his actions. He has no free will. Oh, he can perform with more or less grace, but he can't change any of the outcomes. Or even worse, life is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury. We haven't even got the vibrant existence of actors. We are merely characters in a tale, flecks of sputum on the drool of an idiot. And the idiot who tells the tale is presumably God. God is a fool dribbling out our histories. Is he right? Many critics, prone to gloom, have been seduced by the commanding mastery of those lines into supposing that this is what Shakespeare thought of life at the time he wrote this play. Other critics have said, of course, this is a bad man. If you kill everybody around you, it ought not to surprise that you find out that you live in a wasteland. We are better guided by Malcolm in saying that the grace of grace finally asserts the power of good men over bad men like Macbeth. I don't know that Shakespeare bothers to decide who is right. That's not his business. His business is to depict the process, the experience. I think that this play is Shakespeare's most searching portrayal of human self-destructiveness. The destroyer, Macbeth and Lady Macbeth, are ultimately self-destroyers. And Shakespeare not only sympathizes with victims and with bystanders, but has the extraordinary range to sympathize with those who do themselves in, with the villains themselves.
The lectures on these tapes are titled William Shakespeare, Comedies, Histories, and Tragedies, Part 3.